This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
So we have two outstanding presenters today, one here in person and one via Skype, and let me introduce them briefly. Both of our presenters, as you may know, have authored this impressive or edited this impressive volume, Suffering in Bioethics, and there's a sheet of information at the back if you're interested in learning how to purchase the book itself. I'm sure Nate and Ron can say more about that as they meet us this afternoon. But in the context of this book, they are really asking, what is the meaning of suffering? How does it relate to pain? If there can be pain without suffering, can there be suffering without pain? Do animals suffer? Does the relief of suffering justify the termination of a patient's life? Do religious traditions ever move from efforts to explain and relieve suffering to positions that justify it and promote it? So this book is filled, again, with important questions for our time. Our seminar this afternoon will be led by Ron Green, who is currently professor of the study of ethics and human values in the Department of Religion at Dartmouth College. He served as the director of Dartmouth's Ethics Institute from 1992 to 2011. Dr. Green is author of 9 books and editor of 3 others. He has also published over 160 articles on philosophical and applied ethics. His co-editor is Dr. Nathan Palpent, and we welcome home Nathan. Nathan's a graduate of Whitworth University in 2001. His wife, Darian, is there with their 2 children. He earned a PhD at the University of Michigan Medical School and is currently an instructor in the Department of Pathology at the University of Washington Institute for Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine. His work in bioethics has focused on stem cell research and genetic engineering issues. He has co-edited the book Human Dignity and Bioethics from Worldview to Public Square, in addition to the one that we are talking about this afternoon. So it's my great pleasure to welcome home Dr. Nathan Palpent.
Thanks, Dale. So as Dale mentioned, I'm coming at this topic from the perspective of a research scientist, and that's really influences the way that I approach this question. And my co-editor, Ron Green, who will be joining us, we're going to have a bit of a conversation this morning, or this evening, about the topics that are covered in the volume that reflect our various interests and expertise. Before we get into this, I do want to make you aware that we're going to try to keep as much time as possible at the end, ideally 15 minutes or so for conversation. So do write down questions as we go along, and we'll try to have as much of a discussion at the end as possible. Just to begin, to set the framework for what we're going to cover today, I want to emphasize this general, how do we approach suffering within contemporary society? We largely approach it from this post-Enlightenment perspective, where we view vulnerability and suffering as something that is a problem that we really are compelled to overcome. And this is in marked contrast to what is traditionally seen in older religious traditions, like the Judeo-Christian tradition, where suffering is seen as something that is a mystery. In the introduction or forward to our volume, our noted ethicist, Daniel Callahan, framed what I think has been really one of the central points and purposes of putting this volume together and the discussions that we hope come from it. He writes this, "Suffering is a neglected topic in bioethics, a word often invoked but rarely analyzed. That omission has occurred in great part because modern medicine is dominated by scientific methods and assumptions. Suffering is treated as an enemy to be conquered, not to be understood." And so the hope that we have in the time that we'll have this evening is to try to bring an awareness of the meaning and the purpose of suffering within the human experience. How should we situate ourselves with respect to suffering and human vulnerability as we try to make very, very complicated decisions about bioethics given the incredible trajectory and momentum that that we see in biomedicine these days. So with that, I am going to transfer the talk over to Ron, who's going to introduce a little bit in the way of giving us a definition of suffering to work from and what are our obligations to suffering. So Ron, why don't you go ahead and take it from here?
Thank you very much, Nick. And I think all of you who put this together this evening. I'm going to be as brief as I can be. Let me second what Nathan has just said about suffering not being a focus of much biomedical ethics. One of our contributors, Barry Hoffmaster, says that suffering is foreign territory for bioethics. And I think that's true in a number of very different ways. One way that it's true that's raised in our volume is the neglect of suffering in medical education. Physicians are trained to treat and cure, but they often do so neglecting the suffering of the patient before them. And this can often actually aggravate the patient's condition considerably. It's foreign territory as well because, as Nathan has just said, scientists and physicians are trained to eliminate suffering, put it out of the picture. And sometimes in doing so, they actually generate new forms of suffering. The whole field of biomedical ethics arose when research aimed at eliminating suffering, we think here of the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, that was aimed at treating and ultimately eliminating that disease, produced a generation of suffering in the research subjects and led to new limitations and constraints on what can be done in the name of reducing suffering. So we have a question of educating caregivers into suffering and also discerning and understanding the moral limits of suffering. Let me briefly offer a definition of suffering that is outlined in several of his writings by one of our contributors, Eric Cassell, Dr. Eric Cassell, and I'm impressed by it. He defines suffering as involving the disruption or destruction of a person's intactness, integrity, and dignity. So it is something that goes to the core of our sense of being a person. Suffering almost usually and always involves pain, but it need not involve pain. We think now of a terminal individual with a wasting disease. She or he may not suffer pain in that condition, but they are suffering. And this is one of the appeals that's often made for physician-assisted suicide or other interventions at that point. We can have pain without suffering. One example, although I've never been there, my wife has, is childbirth, where the pain is often seen as, although unpleasant, not something that occasions suffering. So there's an important understanding of suffering as going to the core of the person's being and threatening the integrity of that core. When that occurs in any form, we're talking about suffering. Let me add in this prefatory set of remarks that I regard suffering as an evil, and as universally an evil. I do not believe, as some individuals do, and Nathan may resonate with some of these points of view because they're in our volume, that the understanding of suffering requires a complex metaphysical or religious view, or as some say, a vision of the good. In other words, to understand the bad, you must understand the good. I don't think that's necessarily true. Suffering is prima facie an evil. Almost every human being wants to ward off those threats to his or her own integrity and the pain often associated with it. This is why medicine and medical cures and treatment are almost universally regarded as goods, because pain is almost universally regarded and suffering are almost universally regarded as an evil. This tells me that we have a prima facie obligation to reduce or prevent suffering where it occurs. And biomedicine is deeply committed to that. One final thought in this regard. Yes, it is true that suffering is often accompanied by goods. The classic example in ethics and theology is the development of character. You have to suffer in life to develop character. There's no doubt about that. But these associated goods do not make suffering itself a good. Suffering is something otherwise prima facie, on the surface, to be reduced, prevented, or eliminated. The goods that accompany suffering are almost present in everything we do in life, Suffering will always be with us. We can quote the New Testament here. The poor will always be with you. Suffering will always be with us as human beings. We don't have to invite or encourage or promote suffering. In fact, just the opposite is true. So I take a very strong view that the purpose of biomedicine is to reduce suffering, and that is almost universally regarded as a good thing. Nathan, I'll turn it over to you.
All right. Thank you, Ron. What I want to follow on here is to look a little bit back on the history within the last 60 to 70 years about how ethics, bioethics as a field, has actually emerged and how its relation to suffering. How has suffering shaped the emergence of bioethics? And Dr. Green already mentioned this in regard to the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, and some of you may be aware of it, but for those of you who don't, I'll give just a brief history on this. It occurred here in the United States by the Public Health Service. They recruited hundreds of African-American men over the course of about between the years 1930, early 1930s to the 1970s. And they were trying to study the natural history of syphilis within the African-American community. And they continued these experiments even after the discovery of penicillin, which is a potent treatment for syphilis. And these atrocities within the public eye, and I think we all resonate with this, is that this should not have happened. There's something about it that says, yes, maybe the rationale for progress, trying to justify the gaining knowledge, these kinds of rationalizations for being able to carry out these experiments, they don't justify the kind of suffering that they cause for those individuals. And we can even consider, of course, the events that happened in Nazi Germany as well. And so this raises an interesting sort of, it's a humbling observation about the human condition, and that is that we are at times capable of incredible sympathy. We are able to come alongside other individuals and enter into their suffering in amazing ways, really, really amazing ways. And at the same time, we can engage with suffering in other ways. That is, we can either be completely oblivious to it. That certainly can happen. We can even be callous to it. We might even see it but not care that it happens. And in the case of the Tuskegee experiments, we might say that we actually have in our own hands the capacity to bring about suffering in other individuals. And so this is, I think, been a real fruit, I suppose, in the sense that the field of bioethics has emerged in a response to recognizing the atrocities that can occur at the hands of human beings in bringing about suffering. And I want to just highlight one of the most important documents that that I think, at least in my consideration of the bioethics history, that came about in 1978. And that's the Belmont Report. So the Belmont Report outlined three major themes that were to underlie our approach to treating human subjects in experimentation. And the first one is respect for persons, that individuals should be treated as autonomous agents, that they are capable of making their own decisions, and that people with reduced autonomy, like children or the elderly or the disabled, are entitled to protection. So that's one of the main tenets. The second, there are two terms. One is this idea of non-maleficence, don't do any harm, and the other is reciprocal, that is beneficence, that we ought to seek the benefit or the well-being of individuals. And the third one is this notion of distributive justice. It deals with the idea of distributing, or the issues of fairness and the distribution of benefits and harm burdens of research to human subjects. And so we have in contemporary research these programs like institutional review boards that oversee the activities of research to try to avoid these kind of atrocities from happening again, at least as much as possible. And so this deals with the notion of conflict of interest, that people might not be, they might try to rationalize certain research projects, at the cost of really compromising the autonomy and respecting the individuals that participate in that study. So these are very important tenets that are upholding current practices in biomedical research and have really been an important sort of emphasizing the importance of bioethics in contemporary biomedicine. So with that, I want to hand the talk back to Ron, who's going to talk about the notion of limits. What are the limits? How do we define limits in regard to our obligations to alleviate suffering?
Yes. Thank you again. And much of what Nathan has just said expresses the concern with limits, that the sheer diminution of suffering is a long-term, what we call consequentialist goal, is not the only consideration in our thinking in biomedical ethics, that there are restraints on the elimination of suffering, the prevention of suffering, that are ethically recommended and required. I'm very much in debt here to philosopher Jamie Meyerfeld, who offers at least four limits to the reduction or prevention of suffering, four ways that we're constrained not to pursue limitless reduction of suffering, if possible. The first he calls a consequentialist limit, and that's simply to be understood on the grounds that if the reduction of suffering produces more suffering, then you don't pursue that course of action. That is working within the currency of suffering. You don't pursue suffering, the reduction of suffering in ways that create more suffering. A good example from biomedical ethics here might be the decision to halt a futile course of chemotherapy for a cancer patient at a point when it's clear that the chemotherapy itself is not achieving its goal and is inflicting greater suffering on the individual. So doctors often face this consequentialist limit. A second limit Meyerfeld offers is a limit on obligatory sacrifice. And actually this and the third go together, the issue of special obligations. There are some utilitarians like philosopher Peter Singer who've argued that we have a virtually limitless obligation to reduce suffering. But Meyerfeld reminds us here that there are limits on obligatory sacrifice. I don't have to give up every possession or power that I have in the aim of eliminating global suffering. I have rights and have permissions to utilize my own resources as I wish. Similarly, I'm permitted to care for my children and give them a decent and good start in life, and not simply redistribute their resources to the suffering and poor of the world. So these two obligatory sacrifice and special obligations place moral limits on our requirement that we reduce suffering. The fourth one is the one that is most interesting. Meyerfeld calls it a deontological limit. And that is the notion that there are certain moral principles or obligations or rules that we put in the way of the obligation otherwise to reduce suffering. Nathan has mentioned one of these. The Belmont principles have a principle of justice. It says, among other things, that the burdens of research and the benefits of research must be fairly distributed. We can perhaps make great biomedical gains by using our prison populations or our hospitalized, institutionalized populations or children in institutional settings as research subjects. But this principle says no. There is a deontological, a duty-oriented limit to doing that. So each of these must be considered and each must be evaluated. The mere fact that something is deontologically, principally asserted, however, is not itself a valid grounds for limiting the reduction of suffering in every case, the obligation to reduce suffering. Let me give you an example. In Roman Catholic ethics, and I don't really want to beat up on the Roman Catholic tradition, Roman Catholics bioethics often invites criticism because it's such a rich and thorough tradition of biomedical teaching. But one teaching is that it is not morally allowable to intervene in the reproductive process to eliminate or to cure infertility in most of the ways that it's now done, for example, in vitro fertilization. There are principles that are invoked here, including the child's right to be born in a natural, be conceived and born in a natural way. Well, that's a deontological principle, and Roman Catholic theoretical documents often affirm it would be nice to reduce the suffering of infertile people, but these principles intrude and tell us that we can't go there. I don't happen to believe those principles are valid. I don't see the validity of a principle that says we cannot intervene in the reproductive process to assist people with tubal blockage or other conditions, that every child must be born in a quote-unquote conceived and born in a quote-unquote natural way. So saying that there are deontological principles only begins the discussion. Then we must ask whether those principles are really true. I will insert here the issue of euthanasia, end-of-life decision-making, physician-assisted suicide. This is an area where principles are much invoked, both for and against, although the relief of suffering is also invoked on the other side to advocate both euthanasia in its many forms and physician-assisted suicide. So here we have a very urgent contemporary discussion around the limitation of the obligation to reduce suffering. Nathan?
Great. Thanks, Ron. So that sets a nice background for another example that I want to bring up here that I have wrestled with quite a bit in how I've journeyed through this notion of suffering in bioethics, and that is to try to understand how competing goods, how we negotiate between competing goods. So Thomas Hobbes has written a very potent notion here that, or phrase here that I've built off of, and it's, he says, power is our present means to obtain some future apparent good. Power is our present means to obtain some future apparent good. Now, biomedicine is a power that is certainly at hand and that we have at our disposal. And we can consider this as a means to achieve some future apparent good. But often, what is that good? We don't always agree on that. And oftentimes, the kinds of goods that we bring into consideration are competing. We can either move in this direction or we can move in this direction. We can't have it both ways. So let me give you an example. And that is this idea of genetic information. Genetic information is just ballooning out. We have so much genetic information, and the technology, the cost for being able to get genetic information is just going down and down and down. And so we have scenarios like pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, in which we can get genetic information from these eggs prior to implantation in vitro fertilization contexts. And this can give us information about diseases, and so we can identify embryos that have this genetic propensity for a disease and try to select for embryos that are going to be healthy. And I think that's actually incredibly important, and it's just an incredible advance in biomedicine that has enabled us to be able to bring about healthy individuals. And the other side of this is an interesting thing that has come about in recent years. Some of you may have heard about it. It's called 23andMe. And it's a company that was able to, basically they would sequence your genome and give you back information about your propensity for any number of diseases, the probability of being able to develop heart disease or breast cancer or diabetes or any of these other kinds of conditions, and it would give you back this information. And so we can see that in one context we are getting information about the genetic inheritance of certain embryos in vitro fertilization, and then on the flip side we have a context in which we can get similar kinds of information from individuals who are in the middle of their life and navigating these questions. And then an interesting sort of phenomenon occurs, and that is that all of our hunger for more information, we think, oh, great, we're going to be able to get my genetic code read and the probability of whether I'm going to get heart disease or not. And then we it all just falls to the floor a little bit. And that is that we suddenly realize that just because we are capable of getting that information doesn't necessarily mean that it is beneficial. That they've actually had to close off that entire side of the company, and that is providing information about the propensity for certain diseases, because then people ended up making healthcare decisions on the basis of these probabilities, not necessarily on the basis of any sort of clinical underpinnings. And so this has created a tremendous problem where information, which is so attractive to us, we think, oh, if we have a little more information, we have more control over our life. And that is a deceptive kind of attraction. And so we have in biomedicine these types of goods where certainly medical technology enables us to be able to get more information, but we have to weigh the benefits and costs of the kinds of goods that we're getting from that technology. And there are limits. If I may say so, there are limits. There is, we need to be self-aware of the consequences of taking actions in using technology to achieve certain ends, because although they may be permissible, they're not always beneficial. And I think that trying to evaluate the kinds of goods that we value about human life, even if it means that we can't control certain things, even if it says, well, I don't want that information because the vulnerability that I have in my life is a part of how I will experience life, and that is an element, that is a sort of value of the human experience. That's a good in itself that is compromised if we just choose to take every power that is made capable to us by technology. So there are two quotes that I want to just share with you, or phrases, that is, that have shaped my appreciation for this. And that is one from an ethicist named William May. And he coined this term, an openness to the unbidden. Openness to the unbidden. And I think that that is something that is really resonates with me in the sense that we ought to appreciate the kinds of values and goods that come from things that we don't just control. There's something about the receptivity to what life brings our way that we need to appreciate. And technology is always giving us new ways to redefine vulnerability, right? I mean, we always have new ways of being able to control our circumstances, but an openness to the unbidden. Let's take into consideration the kinds of goods that we want to protect that are just a part of being vulnerable human beings. The other side of this, or another quote that I want to share, is from a book called Tragic Choices. And Barry Hoffmaster, actually, an author in our volume, made this known to me. It's an incredible quote by two professors, Bobbitt and Calabresi. And I'm going to only share one part of this. And it says, "For it is by the values that are foregone, no less than by the values that are preserved at great cost, that we know a society's character. For it is by the values that are foregone." There are goods that we need to let go of, no less than by the values, those goods that are preserved at great cost. We might actually see the continuation of suffering and vulnerability because these goods are important to us. These kinds of decisions are important for being able to understand our own character. And the things that retain the integrity of our character. And this is challenging for us. We are both morally responsible beings, and we are also morally ambivalent. We don't always know what the right choice is, but we are also simultaneously always responsible for the choices that we make. And so I want to just emphasize here in closing this section that we need to take into consideration that even though we are empowered by technology, we need to take a serious consideration of the goods that we seek. What is it that we want? What is the good that we seek in alleviating suffering that in the ways that we make use of technology for that end? So for the remaining 10 or so minutes, I want to pass it back to Ron. He's going to cover an enormous section of the volume on religion. How does religion influence our approach to suffering, and a few other things, and then I'll make some closing thoughts. So, Ron, it's back to you.
Thank you again, Nathan. Your point about inflicting suffering and opening up questions about the good is very, I want to make an observation, comes very close to mine. I just finished writing a paper for a biomedical ethics journal on genomic newborn screening, which is looming in our future. We already screen newborns for a host of a panel of metabolic disorders. And now the technology is opening up the prospect of screening for limitless genomic variations. Very attractive, catching disease conditions early. But we do then have the question, what else are we opening up and doing? Are we going to create a world where every child is born vulnerable and sick because each of us carries genetic mutations of some sort or the other? Will parental fears impede a child's development? Is this information we really want to know in the first days of life? And so on. So these questions about limits, about the goods that we forego or pursue in choosing to relate to suffering are extremely urgent in bioethics today. Let me segue to the issue of religion. And this is an area of my own special interest and expertise. I almost want to begin with a little bit of a, not a joke, but an observation. It's sometimes said that the clock on the wall of the Vatican is marked out in centuries. Not hours or days or minutes, but centuries. And I think that's a general observation and truth about religions generally. They don't move very quickly to adapt to changing realities. They nourish values and perspectives often centuries or even thousands of years old. And I think that's a fact here, and sometimes it's an opportunity, but sometimes it's a problem in the sphere when we deal with suffering. Religions are limited in several ways in this regard. The first is most of our traditions, and I'm not excluding anything from Asia back through the traditions that draw from the Bible, were formed in an era when there was very little power, to use Nathan's term again, very little power to reduce, eliminate, or prevent suffering. Suffering was an unavoidable part of human existence. Biomedical technologies barely existed. As a consequence, the general tendency of most religions is to accommodate to suffering and to ease suffering through thought and comfort rather than to address it directly, which sometimes makes them unwilling to take the step toward the biomedical reduction of suffering. This tendency is somewhat exacerbated by what might be called, in the broadest sense of the term, theodicy. The effort of religious traditions worldwide to explain suffering in what is otherwise presumed to be a moral world. In the Western traditions, and I'm thinking here now of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the claim is that God is just, God is omnipotent, God is all-loving, all-powerful, all-seeing, which raises the question of how and why can there be the suffering of innocent people, children, for example? How can there be suffering at all? The problem is not too different in the Eastern traditions, where it is alleged that there's a moral principle of karma that governs the world. And yet again, seemingly innocent individuals suffer. So how can we make sense of that? Well, religions facing this problem have very frequently turned to the concept of sin in its many forms to argue that there is no such thing as innocent suffering. All who suffer are guilty in some fashion. In the Eastern traditions, this is traced back to violations and perhaps previous existences. You're a wonderful, charitable, social individual, and you suddenly get a dread disease. Well, perhaps 10 lifetimes ago, you beat somebody up, struck them, and caused injury to them. And now the karmic fruit has ripened. in the Western traditions, it's the same thing is said, even going to the extreme form that innocent children suffer because they're not innocent, because they bear the taint of original sin of some sort, and death and disease and enter the world in that way. Now, I would argue that these are, though profound in certain ways, these are unfortunate concepts when it comes to modern understandings of suffering in the medical and biomedical sphere. I think it's very unfortunate to blame a birth defect of a child in any way on that child, or even the child's parents in most cases. So religions have had some difficulty and problems coming to terms with suffering. There are a number of essays in our volume that have taken this issue on in a theological, ethical fashion. And we have a wonderful essay by Lisa Sewell Cahill looking at the developments within Catholic thinking that are moving away from the association of suffering and sin, or even praising suffering. One of the worst developments is that if suffering is divinely ordained, then in some cases it's good. And in the Christian traditions, this sometimes makes appeal to the example of Jesus Christ, who suffered, such that suffering then becomes transvalued as a positive good thing. And there have been traditions in Christian ethics of accepting bodily suffering as a form of remedial punishment for sin. These ideas and traditions are ancient. They're understandable given where religions came from. But our writers in our book are addressing many of these. The best of these, in my mind, not simply the best, but one of the most forthright, is Protestant theologian ethicist Karen Labax, formerly with the Pacific School of Religion. Karen says that suffering itself is never a good, that suffering in Christianity on the model of Jesus is not to adopt suffering and exhibit suffering and invite suffering, but rather to fight suffering. It is fighting the suffering of injustice and oppression, which may cause suffering in turn. This is true in Jesus' career. But it's not an invited suffering. It's a suffering again that's incurred in the struggle against suffering. Karen Labax doesn't make this point, but I think a really interesting biomedical implication is that the same is true for medical caregivers of all sorts. And I'm not limiting myself to doctors, but also to nursing professionals, paramedical people, researchers. They too incur suffering in the fight against suffering. We think, for example, of this moment of the heroic caregivers involved in the struggle against Ebola, some of whom have died or at least fallen seriously ill in that struggle. I think this embodies a more modern, corrective understanding of where religion fits in suffering, never inviting suffering per se, never ennobling suffering per se, but recognizing that suffering incurred in the struggle against suffering is a religious value and importance. I'll quit on that note.
Great. Thank you, Ron. That's fantastic. You know, in closing, I think what we've tried to do, the volume as a whole has covered a vast territory. And of course, we can't get to all of the issues that are pressing upon us. But nonetheless, it takes on the issues of the experience of suffering. What is the importance of suffering in the human experience? And then delves into a number of ethical issues, including genetic diagnosis, in vitro fertilization. It covers a wide range of religious perspectives on and how we approach suffering. And I think, again, I want to return to what I had mentioned in the very beginning, that we live in a post-Enlightenment society in which we really observe suffering as a problem to be overcome. And I think that the goal that Ron and I had in this volume was to try to redirect our attention. We often use suffering as a rhetorical tool. We can use that as a point of argumentation to try to make a point for something that we want, some good that we foresee. And that's definitely something that is a way that we can use the notion of suffering. But at the same time, It is not, our hope was to try to reshift our attention more toward understanding suffering itself. Rather than trying to make ethical decisions on the basis of leveraging suffering, we want to draw suffering and vulnerability back toward the center of the discussion. I think bioethics has largely used it as a rhetorical tool, and our hope is that this volume is going to help refocus us a little bit more toward trying to understand the meaning of suffering and vulnerability in the human experience. And then from there, trying to evaluate the powers that we're made capable of through biotechnology and medicine, and building an ethic from that standpoint. And so that's been our hope. We've covered a vast territory in this time so far. I hope that it has seeded a few questions in your minds, and we have, 15 or 20 minutes. I hope we can have some good discussion. So, thank you for listening.